Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, a podcast about business, money, and life. Matt has been making money and making mistakes for over 20 years. And in this podcast, he shares his thoughts and stories so you can improve your business, finances, and life, whilst hopefully avoiding the mistakes he and others have made along the way. Listen in and level up.
The actual shop costs, including staff and rates and everything like that, of a retailer is anywhere between 25% and 45% of sales. Whereas if you strip out the marketing cost, the pure cost of distributing online is about 10%, which is mainly the delivery cost. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of the warehouse cost and then delivery cost. So as a percentage of sales, it's dramatically lower.
Hey guys, it's Matt Haycock here. And today I have got with me Mark Pilkington.
Hi.
Mark is the author of Retail Therapy, which I have a copy of me in front of me right here, which is Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Now, Mark argues that while the decline in manufacturing receives more news attention, the retail sector is more important in terms of job numbers. In the US alone, it employs around 30 million people, and in the UK, 10 million people, not just in selling, but in property, manufacturing, logistics, and distribution, etc. So again, just to kind of contextualise where we're at, we're recording this on the 21st of May, two months deep into Corona. Now the retail sector is something that's always on the tip of anyone's tongue. Whether that's coffee morning chat, dinner party chat, the press. I mean, when I go on the radio, one of the things I get asked very regularly about is the retail sector, my views on it. I have investments in the retail sector, and when Mark wrote this book, this was pre-Corona, but as anyone who is even as lightly involved in the retail sector as just being a shopper would know, there's been problems in decline for many years, and I guess that has been amplified and exacerbated, as Mark and I have just been talking about a little bit before we started recording. So would have been very interesting to chat to him anyway, even more so, I think, in light of what's happened over the last 8 to 10 weeks. And this conversation is going to impact, interest, and affect many people. As we've just said in this introduction, retail is not just the shopkeepers themselves. It's the landlords, the service providers, and even the customers at home. So thanks a lot for being here, Mark.
No problem. Very nice to be here.
Very long introduction, that wasn't it? But I think it's just, it is something that is so important to everybody. I just think it's really, essential that we set the scene.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think that, if you're involved with brands, or you're involved with retailing or with online, or you're involved with retail property like malls or shopping centres, the last few years have been extremely challenging, and there have been a number of underlying changes that have been affecting people in those businesses. And of course, coronavirus has come along and has accelerated a lot of those trends. So really, I just want to, maybe I'll start off by covering those trends, the sort of top three or four trends that we're seeing. So the most obvious, and I guess everyone would say this if you ask them, is obviously the growth of the internet, which has provided, e-commerce has provided an alternative to buying through shops. And it's a very big change in the supply chain because, it essentially enables people to miss out the shop's stage of the supply chain. In the old days, you had factories sold to brands, brands sold to shops, and then shops sold to people. And people contributed to the process by showing up to the shops and picking the things up and carrying them home. So that was the old supply chain up till about 30, 40 years ago. It really came about at the time of the Industrial Revolution, so about 200-300 years ago. And the Industrial Revolution put production into mass factories, which dramatically lowered the cost of production. But as the product moved up that chain to the consumer, through those stages, it actually added back quite a lot of cost. And actually, if you look at a branded product sold in, say, in a department store, it's actually sold for maybe 7 or 8 times the factory cost. Okay, and it hasn't changed since it left the factory. It went to a brand who stacked their name on it and did a lot of advertising, who sold it through their sales force into a retailer, who then put it in their stores so you could get at it. And there's a lot of cost in the stores, so they add their markup. And they all add their markups. By the time you, the consumer, get it, it's 7 to 8 times what it costs to produce. Now, what's happened is that the e-commerce has come along and enabled people to miss out the retailing stage, which is a huge chunk of cost And you know, the costs of selling online are dramatically lower than selling through shops. That's the first thing. The second thing is, which is sort of linked to the same technology, but it's actually separate, is what I call the communications revolution. Because if you think back 30, 40 years ago, maybe you're younger, but you know, in those days, where did people get their information about products from? They got it from the brands. They didn't have an independent way of verifying product quality, service levels, or anything like that. And that's all changed. So the monopoly that the brands and retailers had over information is gone. Because now where do we get information about products? We get it from peer-to-peer reviews and through influencers and through price comparison sites. So the internet revolution has also revolutionized communication, and it's democratized communication. So now anyone can post a review, and you know, if it says this product is rubbish, it could go viral, and you know, that's the end of that brand. So the consumer now has the power in the relationship, whereas 30, 40 years ago, it was the manufacturers and the brands that had the control. So that's the second big change. I mean, the third big change, because of the e-commerce, is that the actual final bit where the consumer has to go to the store and pick it up has actually gone. So, you know, people talk a lot about the cost of online being lower, but that convenience factor is absolutely massive. So those are changes on the supply side. Now, on the demand side, we've seen a substantial shift, actually, of assets into the hands of older people, because with the asset boom, you know, cheap money, you know, lax money, assets have exploded, incomes haven't, and so, you know, the ordinary person who is on who's earning, who is typically younger, is been stuck with a 10% increase since the 1990s in real terms, whereas the old generation that owned the assets, you know, before the 1990s and had shares or had pension funds or had properties, they've seen that those go up 10 times. And as a result, 85% of the wealth in Britain is owned by people over 45. Now, the problem for that with retailing is that it's young people who support retailing. Lots and lots of retail categories like fashion, beauty, homemaking, etc. All the categories around those, it's all younger people. That's who support it traditionally. And those people haven't got any money these days. So there's more people living with their parents today, obviously, even more so now with coronavirus. I'll come on to coronavirus, but even before coronavirus, there's more people actually living with their parents since the war. Okay, so the financial independence of young people has disappeared, and people are staying at home. They're not getting married. They're not having children, and they can't get on the housing ladder very easily because property is so expensive. So it's very difficult for them to go through the normal life stages that previous generations did, and that change in spending power. So you've got the older people who've got the money, but they're not really spending it because, you know, or they're not spending it on those categories, that's for certain. And then you've got the younger people who haven't got it. They'd love to spend it, they haven't got it. So that's the basic sort of thing. So on the supply side, you've got a revolution that is massively reducing costs and handing the consumer power. And on the demand side, your prime people who buy retail stuff and brands haven't got any money. So you stick those...
Can we just put a timeline on this insofar as when, you know, how far back you would say that this has started, and maybe percentage-wise, you know, where this impact has grown?
Well, obviously, you've got the different strands to it. I mean, I think the internet side, we all know about that. I mean, I did a .com in 1999, and we thought that it was going to destroy retail then, but of course it didn't. But in the intervening 20 years, of course, it's grown every year. And it now, in November, it reached 19% of the UK market. Of course, with coronavirus, it's now gone up to 24, 25%. Anyway, but so that's happened over the last 20 years. And the communication revolution really kicked in when we got social media. So, 2008, 2009 onwards. And then the income distribution problem's been building up since the 1990s with the asset booms. And so it's really over the last 20 years, but it hit a critical point for retail in about 2015. Retail had been piling along, adding stores, adding malls, adding, you know, in the States and in the UK, adding capacity until 2015. And then in 2015, it's like the brakes went on suddenly. It's like the critical mass was reached, and they really started to hit the skids. And a lot of retailers have gone bust from 2015 onwards. In this country, obviously, House of Fraser, Debenhams, Mothercare, Toys R Us. These are the most famous ones, Arcadia, etc. So it's been building up. And, you know, I wrote the book basically before, you know, coronavirus, although I've put in a little bit about coronavirus in the edit, essentially. Now, so that's a 20-year process. But then if you take coronavirus on top of that, so what the book essentially said was, look, these trends are all going to continue. Technology is going to continue to improve the online offer, et cetera, et cetera. Then coronavirus comes along and it's really speeded the whole process up. A lot of people now have shifted to online. So, for example, in grocery in the UK, I think in early April, around 44% of people had bought grocery online, whereas 2 years before it was about 20-something percent. So that's a massive, dramatic shift. Grocery was one of the last holdouts, really, of online. And in non-food, it's gone up as high as, obviously, with most of the non-food being closed, it's gone as high as 60-70% of the market being bought online. So, you know, the problem with that for the retailers is that shifting online is something that is quite difficult for consumers to do, and it's quite difficult for the e-commerce companies to recruit people. It's expensive and complicated. But once they've got people's data and they've established a relationship, because online marketing is essentially like relationship management marketing, because you've got all the details of the consumer, it's much easier to continue that and keep it going. So that looks like a structural shift that is not going to fully reverse after coronavirus is over. And then on top of that, we're going to have, you know, the mother of all recessions, which is also going to put pressure on the retailers. Just generally, everyone's going to be affected. So really what the book is about is, you know, in that environment, if you're a retailer or you've got a shopkeeper or whatever, whether you've got one store or 10 stores or whatever, or you work for one of the big groups, if you work for one of the brands who supply retailers, or if you work in people who supply into the retail trade, I work with agents, you know, advertising agents and things like that. And also, critically, the retail property people, because there's a lot of money tied up with malls and shopping centers and commercial property. If you work in those sectors, what is it you're going to do? Because it's going to be like being a coal miner in the 1930s. It's going to be very, very difficult for you. And that's really what the book's about. How can you design your brand, your shop, et cetera, so that you can move forward in a positive way?
And if I was to maybe potentially oversimplify this, are we saying that this is very much the world is now completely online, or if not completely, growing at such a dramatic rate that in the fullness of time it will be completely online? So shift your model completely, otherwise you will be out of business. Or do you believe there are still some things that can be done to make the offline retail experience more interesting, and therefore, let's say, keep some people offline longer? Do you think there's a place for the two, or are we ultimately going to get to a place where there are no shops whatsoever?
Well, I think the important thing, and this is the critical distinction, is that shops always had two functions, right? The prime function of shops was to be basically a staging post for the industrial machine where consumers could pick up the goods. Okay, it's very simple, right? They're basically warehouses in convenient places where you can come and pick up the products from the Industrial Revolution, okay? That the factories can churn this stuff out, but you've got to have access to it. So access and stocking and displaying goods and getting the consumer to pick up the goods there, that was the prime function of retailing. It always had a secondary function, which we call broadly marketing, which was, you know, to introduce the brand, to talk to people, to discover their needs, to advise them, to enthuse them about the product, to sell the product to them, to produce, you know, an attractive display to enhance the brand. So people, we all know with brands, you're not just buying the product, you're also buying the brand image and you're buying the experience. So it always had those two roles. And with the developments I've described, you know, with the communications revolution and with the internet revolution, e-commerce has become better in a general sense at shifting goods from factories to consumers. That role is now more efficiently done. And there's lots of reasons for that. The prime one, of course, is what we all know, which is it's a lot cheaper to have a little warehouse in some industrial estate. You don't pay as much rates, you don't pay as much rent. You can have a few people doing it and you can shift a lot of product online. It's a lot less expensive. I mean, typically the cost of stores, the actual shop costs, including staff and rates and everything like that, of a retailer is anywhere between 25 and 45% of sales. Whereas if you strip out the marketing cost, the pure cost of distributing online is about 10%, which is mainly the delivery cost. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of the warehouse cost and then delivery cost. So as a percentage of sales, it's dramatically lower. Then on top of that, you've got another factor, which is the cost and the risk of stock. see, like I used to work in retailing, and every year we had 800 stores. So every year we'd make a collection and we'd copy stamp this collection across 800 stores. You know, we'd have 800 stocks of this. And of course, the first week, the best sellers would go out of stock in the best stores. And then the worst sellers would pool, you know, in the low selling stores, and the stock would all be in the wrong place. So in order to sell, you had to have a huge amount of stock, or you sold the consumer something they didn't really want. In other words, they went in for the thing in blue and you sold it to them in red. You flipped them into the other because you didn't have it. So from a stock point of view, it's very, very expensive to have like 800 stores all with the stock. Mm-hmm. out there, and it's very inefficient. I mean, in America, 15% of sales are lost through out of stocks. So it's very inefficient. Now, if you've got a good centralized warehouse with one stock, you know, it's dramatically more efficient. And then that's not introducing stock risk. So if you take the traditional model of the supply chain, you've got stock everywhere, from the factories going to the brands, their warehouses, to the retailers, their warehouses, in the stores, etc. You've got a huge amount of stock. If you make a mistake and you have a quality problem, or the product isn't right and it doesn't sell, you've got all that pipeline, which is basically worthless almost. So, you know, having a lot of stock is a, you know, the French say le stock qui tue, it's the stock that kills. You know, stock, having too much stock kills businesses. And the retail online model is much more efficient. So the key point is, it's a more efficient model for shifting goods. You know, if you go into a store, I mean, retailers have to wake up and smell the coffee. It actually is not a very pleasant experience shopping in a store in general. I mean, when people talk about the pleasure of shopping, they tend to think of maybe going fashion shopping with their buddies or whatever, and having a good time and having a coffee on the way. So yes, that can be pleasant, but most retail is not that. Most retail is more of a necessity purchase. You go into the store, the signposting is not very good, particularly in large stores, to try and find what you want. You eventually find it. There's often a lack of product information. It's often out of stock, as I've said. And then you take it, you know, you try and get help, you can't find anybody. You take it to the till, there's a queue, you know, the till's slow or whatever, and you can't check out very easily. And, you know, retail is a low wage occupation. It's a minimum wage occupation. It used to be a good career for people, but it's stopped being. It's now one of these sort of 0 hours contracts type jobs. And retail turnover is very high. And therefore, the chances are that the person who's serving you doesn't know very much more about the product than you do. And therefore, the amount of value out of that human factor is very, very small. And that's retail. You compare that with a website. You go to a website, you've got a nice search engine to find the product. The product information is laid out in a standardized, efficient way with lots of information. And then in a lot of retail, a lot of websites, you can do a one-click checkout or whatever. It's extremely efficient. And you know, compared with the messy situation in retail, which often is reality, it's more efficient. So from a cost point of view and an efficiency point of view, it's a lot easier to buy things online. And then, of course, you've got the fact that it comes to your house. You haven't got to do the final mile yourself. So right now, I mean, I, as a guy, you know, I used to write shopping lists for things that I needed, and I'd spend 10 minutes writing my shopping list, and then I think, oh God, where am I going to get this? Where am I going to get that? Now I can just go on Amazon, and in the time it takes me to have written it, wouldn't take me to write that shopping list, I can just buy it on Amazon, you know, and it's done, and I don't have to think about it. So from a convenience point of view, from an efficiency point of view, and above all, from a cost point of view, shifting goods from factories to consumers is easier done through centralized warehousing and through e-commerce sites. So the fact that the consumer has got the ability to get goods at the click of everywhere, and that will only go forward in the future. You'll be able to soon buy from your car. You'll be able to buy, you know, voice commerce will come in. You'll be able to just say, get me this, and something will get it for you. You know, a lot of things will move on to automatic replenishment, things that are boring type repeat products like your Persil or your salt or your boot polish or whatever. A lot of that will just be done on predictive reordering. In other words, some kind of website will take care of you. They'll look at your demand pattern and they'll ship it to you and invoice it to you. And if you want it to stop, you just press a button for it to stop for a bit. But a lot of that will just be, you'll have smart fridges that will know how much butter you've got and it'll reorder it for you. So in the future, a lot of that will just be below the level of consciousness. It won't be something that people think about. Stuff will just show up. And so all that transactional side is going to be better done online. So if you take that out, you're then left with the other bit, which is what I call the marketing bit, which is a broad term, but it's the bit that you add value to by having a physical space. Yeah. And the problem, if you look at that, If you want to optimize that, you've got to have a few things in place. The first thing is you've got to have something that you can't get online. Okay, so you've got to have some kind of experience or some kind of service or some kind of learning or environment that is more fun or better than what you get online, because you're going to pay extra for it because it's going to cost to have it. And therefore, it's got to deliver a value add. And it's only in delivering, really focusing on that value add, that retailers and brands and people in that sector can entice consumers to come there rather than just buying online. That's the fundamental thing. It's actually focusing in on that non-goods bit of marketing, because the goods bit can be done anyway. Do you see what I mean? So that's the fundamental. There's a whole bunch of ramifications from that.
So I guess putting this into a simple, let's say, call it a 3-point plan for, you know, for smaller independent retailers now who probably live a life of complaining incessantly about, you know, about rates and rents and the you know, decline caused by Amazon. You know, now they are starting to understand the reality that you are explaining. You know, what is the simple solution? Just accept this is going online and, you know, embrace the strategies and technologies as best as possible.
Yeah, I mean, basically the fundamental thing is to understand that, you know, how you can, it's not about fighting online, that's the wrong solution. It's about using online, and it's basically to move the good side of your business online, okay, and then use your physical spaces for something else. Doesn't mean you don't have any goods in your store, but, you know, when you look at most stores, they are 80-90% of the space is devoted to just stock. It's just serried ranks of stock, you know, most of which doesn't move, by the way. I mean, if you take the average retail operation, most of the stock doesn't move from year to year or from month to month. You know, it just sits there. An awful lot of it doesn't sell. And you know, if you work for a retailer, you'll know, or a brand actually, but retailers particularly, you've got this long tail of products that don't really sell anything. They're there to sort of make up, you know, because someone comes in occasionally and wants it, or you've got to fill the space with something or whatever. But if you look at most retail product profiles, you've got a few things that sell really, really well, and then you've got a long tail of things that don't really sell. So the first thing is to start with the tail and start to move that online. So rather than having serried ranks of stock in your store, why don't you put a few big screens? You can now, the cost of those technologies coming down a lot, you can get interactive screens, you can get very good visual screens where you can demonstrate the product without having it physically there. So you can show it in great detail, you can move it around, you can demo it. You can now get technologies that, you know, if the consumer's wearing it in red, it'll take a video of them and it'll, you can flip it into blue. So you don't need the blue, you know what I mean? So lots of, I wouldn't recommend, you know, starting with big bang and taking all the stock out, but you start with your lowest selling products and you start to try and sell them online and to have, invest in the technology rather than the stock. So that you can use screens, a bit like, well, effectively the screens are your website. You have an efficient website, you use the website, show people things and transact. And then you have you keep your best sellers in the store so you can demo them. But essentially, don't also, even when you sell it, right? When you come to selling the product, don't physically give the stock to the consumer, because you want to educate the consumer to buy it online, actually. Yeah. You want the buying bit to be online. So when you get to the point of sale, what you do is capture the consumer's detail and essentially transact on the website. And that's going to be a real godsend to most retailers, because the problem is most retailers got two information systems. They've got their online information system and then they've got their store till information system, and now the twain shall meet. And so what I'm suggesting is that instead of having a till system, you just basically use your website to transact. Now, you may choose to actually give the consumer the stock in the store. You can do that. The system will just treat the store as another warehouse. So when it comes to selling, recording the sale, you can either record it as shipped from store or shipped from warehouse, interchangeably. But you need to try philosophically to move most of it to ship to warehouse. So the stock doesn't touch the store, it comes straight from the warehouse to the consumer. So you may have to incent the consumer to sign up because they're busy, they may not want to give their details. You may have to offer them a gift or offer them a small discount to get them. But you really want to capture their details and get them onto your online platform, because in the future, once you've got them on your own online platform, it's much cheaper to market to them. The cost of marketing for online is very high to capture the consumer, but very low to remarket to existing consumers. A, because you know what they want, so you can do predictive offers. And B, because all you've got to do in order to reactivate them is send an email, which is basically free. Whereas the recruitment process involves paying Facebook and Google tons of money to recruit them. So that's the key thing, is to distinguish between the customer capture and the customer remarketing, the lifetime value of that customer. And the capture bit is actually very efficiently done in store because they're there with you. And you can, if you've got good salespeople, you convince them. So the key first thing is to try and capture their detail and transact with them online and then ship to them either from the store or ship to them from your warehouse if they can wait, or you can incent them. You're trying to get the habit of doing the buying bit online. Now, once you start doing that, you then start to look at your store and move the space subtly. Again, I wouldn't do anything overnight, but move the space. Try and devote more space to brand and less space to stock. I mean, one of the things you can do as you move more people to buying from your warehouse and shipping from your warehouse, and you don't need as much stock in store, one of the things you can do is you can look at shrinking your store. Now, for a small retailer, they may not be able to do that, but there's lots of retailers that have quite large spaces. They may have 200, 300, 400 meters, and they're paying a ton of money for that meterage. Now, again, this is not cannot be done overnight, but when you're looking at lease renewals, and of course, big groups, they renew leases all the time. One of the things I advise retailers is look to shrink the size of your store, because when you don't need all that stock, you don't need stores that are, you know, hundreds and hundreds of square meters, because you're paying through the nose for that to essentially warehouse your stock in a very expensive place. I talk about lean stores. So you don't need huge stores. What you really need is a small to medium sized store with a large front of house where you interact with your clients and less space devoted to stock. So you try and move it in that direction over time. Then the next thing you look at is if you look at the economics of how stores actually work, is that staff spend over half their time on non-customer related matters. They spend it on moving stock around, booking stock in, doing a lot of stuff with stock, administering the store, doing the cashing up and taking it to the bank, et cetera, and at the till, operating the tills. So they're not actually spending, about 70% of their time is not spent talking to customers. So you need a lot of people to do that. In a big store, you need tons of people to, and that's why when you go into a store and you try and get service from the sales assistant, they're usually writing something in a book or hanging some stock up, whatever, and they're like, I'll get to you. Yeah, well, because they're actually doing administrative type work linked to the stock, and they can't focus on you. You need a lot of people to do that. And that's one of the reasons why retailing is very poorly paid, because you need a lot of staff to administer all this stock. So if you get rid of all of that, or most of that, the store staff can just focus on the consumers. So you can have fewer staff and you can pay them more. And it's very important to pay them more, because you need to have good people. You need to have well-trained people, and you need to retain the people. It has to be a proper career again. So rather than having tons of people doing all this administration, have fewer people and pay them more money. Because it's that person that is one of the critical distinguishing factors between you and the internet. They can go to the internet and they can get a basic level of automated service for very little money. So if you're going to pay someone to be in a store, you've got to make sure that they're doing something that the internet's not doing. So I always think of it as more like unemployed actors or actresses or personal shoppers, whatever you want to call them. But you need people who are charismatic, who engage people, who want to interact with people. And spend more time with people, because when you think about this as customer recruitment as opposed to just transacting, how much would you spend to recruit a customer on Facebook? You can spend like £20-25 to recruit a customer on Facebook for one customer. Now, you know, you need to spend the time recruiting your customer in your store. So when customers come in and they want to buy clothing or whatever, sit them down, make an appointment, give them a glass of champagne, give them a nice coffee or whatever, or a beer or whatever it is they want, some nice eats, have a lovely changing room, have a comfortable seating area, and have a high level personal shopper who'll spend an hour with them and talk through their needs and show them lots of stuff and fit things and do all the things that you can do in store. So that high quality of service is absolutely essential. It's the only thing, it's one of the few things that protects the retailer against the competing online offers. And, you know, these are all things that you can do.
So, and to go slightly in parallel with this now, because obviously, you know, what we talk a lot about and what people always think about is the retailer themselves. But I guess, you know, what a lot of people miss is the big problems that the landlords, that, you know, the big property groups have, where obviously a lot of the things we've just talked about now are, you know, reasonably immediately implementable things that retailers can try, you know, if not immediately, like you say, you know, gradually over time. But you've got a much different problem on your hands when you've got millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of pounds of capital invested in you know, in city centre retail, in shopping malls, in whatever your, you know, product categories are as a landlord. I mean, where is the future for these guys?
Well, it's one of the things I was going to say, just to finish off, which is going to have application for the question you've just asked, and it's probably the most important, is that the third area, apart from service and the shape of the store, is what we call entertainment or experience, and that is to provide a three-dimensional brand experience, which might be educational, it might be about how the product's made, it might be about just the visuals, using screens and these sort of things, to make the store really dynamic, impactful environment, which most stores aren't. And to do something you can't do online. So that's the third leg of the retail bit. Now, when we move to the bigger scale, which is shopping centres, even high streets, really, any larger area where you're selling, is the same thing, which is that at the end of the day, you've got to provide an experience for the consumer. And I see the future of these kind of areas as being a mixture of you know, high-quality street food, entertainment, live entertainment, and then new brands and new experiences with brands and retail. And I think it's those mixed use. We already see thriving areas like, well, pre-coronavirus, we saw thriving areas like Borough Market, packed with people. I don't believe fundamentally, and there's lots of research on this, I don't think that sitting on at home on your phone is making people happy. In fact, there's lots of research that shows it's making people very unhappy. So I think that there's going to be a premium in the future for entertainment and for social, the creation of physical communities. And I think that's essentially what shopping centres have to do. And so they have to see themselves as being not just retailing with a fringe of sort of food around the edge and a bit, tiny bit of entertainment, the occasional brass band playing or something like that in the middle of the mall. It's got to become a much more entertainment-based model. And I think part of, and a much more innovation-based model, because most malls and shopping centres, they've got exactly the same retailers. You know, you go to any shopping centre in the UK, you're going to have a Boots, you're going to have a WH Smith, you're going to have, you know, maybe an M&S, you're going to have, you know, these, you know, Dixons. It's all the same everywhere. And those guys now are dying off, you know. And but the good news is there's a massive explosion in innovation, mainly in direct-to-consumer online brands. There's a huge, huge explosion in entrepreneurial small businesses offering very exciting, interesting new products and services. And many of those online companies and brands would love to have a sort of retail presence, but not in the way that retailing has typically worked. So in the old days, you know, you had to get a 5, 10, 15-year lease, and it's a huge cost and risk commitment for a brand. Though you know, these online players, they're not really retailers, and they're not going to want to engage in that kind of risk and that kind of cost. But they would love to have, you know, a step up from a pop-up store, but a better pop-up. Pop-up stores are problematic. So a better pop-up store that they can just go and do a marketing. They see it as a marketing campaign. They want to go and harvest some consumers from a high-traffic location, move them online, and then market to them online, make money online. And so they do their recruitment. So it's the same model as I described earlier. You think of your store as a recruitment vehicle. That's the online people. That is where the innovation, and that is where the potential customers of the malls can be, because the brands that can go into malls. The malls need to change their model. And the idea was, historically, is the mall, you built the mall, you created the frame, the spaces, and the retailers did the rest. They came in, they spent 4 to 6 months building the store, they put in all the technology, and they put in the build, and they made it as beautiful as they could. And then they'd run it for 10, 15 years and eventually make money back off it. But, you know, it was a big commitment. The online players aren't going to want to do all that. It's too complicated. So the responsibility for the organization of the space and the technology in the space needs to move to the malls. So I talk about plug and play brand spaces rather than shops. I think you see it more like an exhibition type thing, a brand exhibition, like where you wholesale products to retail customers, like an exhibition. So you have these spaces, and the malls need to pre-equip them with a kind of technology that almost replicate a website. So when you're on a website, everything is tracked. As soon as you come on a website, they know where you go. They know when you abandon basket. They know when you walk away. Stores have none of that at the moment. And there is technology that can do that, but it's expensive. And as I say, the brands aren't going to want to get involved. To do a 3-month, 6-month campaign, they're not going to be bothered with all of that. The malls need to take care of that. They need to equip these spaces so they're like physical websites in terms of technology. So they show how many customers are walking past, how many come in, how many convert, where they convert, where in the store they're buying, and where do they leave, you know, where do they go to and then leave, all those kind of things. All of that can be tracked in real time. If a mall were to equip spaces like that, smaller spaces, they could pull in this vast army of online brands to run short-term campaigns, 3 to 6 month campaigns, and use technology to help them. So technology also now, you can put screens on the walls effectively that can flip a store from being, say, Nike to being Marks and Spencer's in a second. Okay, so you don't need to spend on all the physical hardware in the store, apart from a few tables and things like that. You basically, if you put lots of screens in, it's very easy. You can just change brand really, really easily. I've seen it done. Heathrow did it, and they flipped a space in 5 seconds. It was most dramatic. They changed it from one store to another store. The screens were like in seconds, and then of course they put the product out. That took about a few hours, but certainly not 6 months to build it. So you know, you're dramatically reducing the setup time. And if you do that and offer people short-term leases, like 3-6 months, so they can run campaigns, you'll pull in that vast army of up-and-coming brands, where all the innovation is, which is going to be good for the malls because it will fill the malls with you know, brands, and keep their revenues flowing. But it's also good for the malls because of the consumer. You see, the consumer will see a changing roster of innovative brands where they can go in and interact with the brands, whereas you know, the old shopping center, you know, with all the same stores all the time, is actually really dull. It's so dull. It's like the elephant in the room is how dull retailing is in most shopping centers. When in this model, it wouldn't be dull. Every time you went, you'd see different stores and different brands, different experiences. You mix that in with the layers of entertainment and layers of food, and also try and make it more of a community. So you have a kind of community aspect to it. I think that's attractive. I think that will pull people out of their homes because people want to go in buzzy places and hang out and see fun things and interact, meet people. They don't want to sit lonely at home. So I think that's the fundamental shift. It's really the same thing on a bigger scale. Move away from the transactional side of malls and shops being about getting goods to people, and turn them into beautiful kind of entertainment fun places where you can have a day out, which is what they were in the 50s. When people first went to malls, they found them amazing because, of course, people's expectations were lower in those days. It just needs to make that step so that it meets people's expectations of today, which are higher.
Well, listen, Mark, I mean, you've only been talking for half an hour, and the stuff you've been telling me, I mean, I've got my brain ticking over for wanting to jump on the phone to call the managers and people in my retail businesses right now. I mean, it has genuinely been a very, very, very interesting half hour with you. And I think, you know, for anyone at home who's been listening to this, they're going to be wanting to run out and pick up that book now, because it's like we said at the beginning, the content we've been talking about today has got so many applications, you know, whether you are a retailer, a consumer, a landlord, and you know, it impacts on everybody in some way, shape or form. Where can people find out more about you? Where can they go and buy the book from? I presume online after everything we've been saying.
They can buy it in bookstores as well. They can buy it on Amazon. They can buy it on bloomsbury.com. That's the publisher. If they want to contact me, my website's markpilkington, all one word, .net. So that's where my, you know, I do other stuff as well.
Oh, good. And you presumably do consultancy type work.
Yeah. I also build brands. I do quite a lot of work now with building new online brands. And you know, so it's really, you know, if you were a brand or you're a retailer, it's, you know, I run a $350 million retail business with 850 stores. So, and I started an online brand in 1999. I worked in branding for many, many years. So I've done everything from, you know, sweeping the warehouse to grand strategy and IPOs and things. I can help businesses, any business, small or large, I can help it to transform in a practical way.
Perfect. Well, guys, just to repeat that, it was markpilkington.net, you said, didn't you, Mark?
Yeah.
Markpilkington.net. And here is the book, Retail Therapy, Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. So please, guys, check out Mark, check out the book. Mark and I talked about it offline. I don't know if he mentioned it at the beginning, but he's writing a second book now to take account of Corona-related stuff as well. So, Mark, thanks a lot for being here. And I'm sure we'll be speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, Matt. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks, buddy.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to The Matt Haycock Show. For more Matt, check out his YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Matt Haycock. Or go stalk him on Instagram and Twitter, The Matt Haycock. And we'll see you soon.